Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show, European edition. As the terraces across Europe stay packed with neighbours doing sing-along and Nessun Dorma, we're out on our metaphorical balcony to field your questions, talk a bit of Alan Pardew, and discuss the first ever Champions League final and the team that brought shame on the European game, even though they weren't Italian. All that and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Well, going to reassure Skin Deep, Lil' Kim and the whole R&B community that there is no more playing for the moment. From Munich to Monaco, they've hung up their shooting boots. It is Frontier Saint-Jean. James Horncastle, Julien Laurent and Raphael Honigstein are here with us. Hi, brothers.
Hello.
How you doing, Jules?
I'm good, thank you. And you?
Yeah, I'm pretty well. James, how are you feeling? This is from Aniket. Aniket writes in and says, how is James feeling after his Wednesday night Champions League predictions?
Oh, yeah. It feels like an awful long time ago.
Doesn't
now.
It, though? Doesn't yeah. It? You said Atletico would go through against Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said the PSG would be fine against Borussia Dortmund.
I did
say that.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Which after my Atalanta group stage, I
that's
mean.
That's right. Oh you gosh. Also, yeah. We had another question actually asking when and where you're going to be having your celebratory dinner. You know, as soon as possible and socially responsible as well.
Mm. Well deserved as well. Well deserved. Well done.
Just is only saying that because I predicted PSG to go
get
through.
Get in. And, yeah. Get in. If you mention yeah. it, yeah.
Yeah. And, oh, righty. Well,
they're so likable in there. And they win.
Who trolled first?
Such nice people.
Who trolled first? Don't troll if you don't want to get trolled back.
Wise words, Jules. Let's start off in traditional fashion with a quick roundup of the headlines. Italy suspended all football last Wednesday. Spain followed suit on Thursday. France did the same on Friday morning. And Germany suspended all football on Friday afternoon. We chilled on Sunday. Rafa, why did Germany leave it so late?
Germany thought that they could stage the whole program for the weekend behind closed doors. Things only really changed when the Paderborn coach, Stefan Baumgart, Paderborn was supposed to play on Friday night, was suddenly suspected of having contracted the virus, was tested. Actually, the test result came back negative. But while this was going on, the municipality of Bremen also decided themselves they were going to call off the game, I think against Leverkusen, because they said they cannot guarantee the avoidance of scenes that we had seen, for example, in Paris and in Gladbach with fans congregating outside the stadium. They saw that as a health risk and made the decision unilaterally. And the league, having decided within the space of like a few hours that the games were all going to be on, then did an abrupt U-turn and called them off also in response, I guess, to a lot of players voicing their unease and Thiago being very critical and even addressing the DFL in his first tweet. Then it was deleted, the DFL, the Bundesliga at Twitter tag was taken out, but he was very unhappy and many players were too.
Similar timing to the Premier League, of course, with Arteta on Thursday night and then suddenly it's all off. UEFA meeting Tuesday afternoon, virtually at least, with a lot of people suggesting that a European Championships in December 2020 is going to be the first step in their solution. Brilliant, no?
Brilliant in the sense that...
No, I think that'd be exciting.
You'd enjoy, yeah, maybe. It Christmas could be then. Euros. It could be as well in January, February. So when some players are in the Africa Cup of Nations, then the others play the Euro as well. Or the following summer 2021. But it will certainly be postponed for sure.
Okay. Many unknowns, many known unknowns. In the meantime, is everyone else getting as worked up about completing the season in other countries like France, Germany as they are here, yeah?
There was a big meeting on Monday afternoon from the 36 Bundesliga clubs. And while they didn't come up with any firm decision, any firm solution, they made it very clear that, A, it's not realistic to assume that games will be back on in April. They don't see that as a realistic timescale. So they will reconvene at the end of March to make another assessment. But according to Christian Seifert, the CEO of the league, he thinks that having ghost games, games behind closed doors, as we call them in Germany, will be the only way to ensure that the season will be finished. And finishing the season is absolutely imperative as far as the financial survival is concerned. In the Bundesliga, all 36 clubs from Bundesliga 1 and 2 share the TV package. That's why it's perhaps a slightly more acute problem than it, compared to the Premier League, where it's only the top 20 teams that are hugely affected in terms of the Premier League not being. In the Bundesliga, the effect is more keenly felt immediately for the smaller clubs. And they don't think that is viable if the TV companies basically don't pay the next, I think it's just under 100 million euros that they were due to pay at the end of March for the next staggered rights. And without that money, there'll be problems.
TV companies who have got their own issues right now, Andy Dawson pointing out, not saying BT Sport is struggling to fill their schedules, but Tuesday morning featured not only 2019 Classic Tetris World Cup, episode 12.
I mean, to be fair, I'd watch that.
Yeah, me too.
I checked, it genuinely is on. And Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest.
Again, I'd watch that. In fact, I think those two things.
Right, okay.
Are in some respects more appealing than some Premier League games.
Right, BT Sport ESPN is the place to yeah. find that. Greg Stevenson asks, do the guys have any insight in what it's like for foreign players in the UK witnessing vastly different measures to those in their home countries? Jules, are there, a lot of the foreign players from Premier League sides, have they gone home? Or are they here and kind of just standing by?
They're here. I don't think their clubs would allow them to move, and especially move in countries if you're Italian, Spanish or French, where it's actually worse than it is currently here. So it would be crazy to say to someone, yeah, go home and see your family or whatever and go into a more infected area of Europe. So they're all staying put. I mean, at least the one I know, working on their own in their, you know, own gym or the garden or whatever, and trying to stay as fit as they can. They can't work too hard because they don't want their immune system to be weakened. That's why the clubs are saying to them, you can't go too crazy on your fitness work, but you need to try to stay fit as much as you can, because there might be a point where you would have to go back in the season, and it right. would be very hard for them, fitness-wise, to go back into the rhythm.
Curious what's happened to players who moved in January and who haven't got an apartment or haven't found a place to live yet and have been kind of living in hotels. You look at what's happened to Christian Eriksen, who's basically been in a hotel in Milan for the last few weeks. That hotel has closed and he's now living at the training ground, a Piano Gentile, which in terms of keeping fit and that sort of thing, perfect. It's better than some of the other interplayers who live in apartment blocks that either have a condominium gym, which they can't use because they don't know about the safety of it, the hygiene of it. So all those kind of things come into mind. Like Maya Yoshida, for example, who went to Sampdoria, not allowed to kind of leave Italy, not so he can't go and see his family. All these kind of things that you kind of lose sight of and overlook when a crisis like this strikes.
I mean, Cristiano was lucky in a way to be able to go to Madeira where there's no cases. So yeah. it looks safe right now on paper, but, you know, at least he's with his family and stuff.
Absolutely.
And like a lot of others.
Wonder how Alan Pardew's doing in the Eredivisie. Is he in lockdown somewhere in The Hague?
I think
lockdown in The Hague. Yeah, that kind of lockdown.
Well,
I think the club's ultras would rather him being in lockdown.
Well, up next, actually, let's find out the latest on Pards and Chris Powell as we dial up Mikko Jongsma to hear about the Eredivisie. Are they playing there? Of course not.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
All right, joining us now on the line is Mikko Jongsma of Opta Johan, all the way from the Netherlands. Hi, Mikko.
Hey, James, how are you?
I'm very well. How's everything going with you? I hear there were exciting lockdown scenes. Were you involved in this rush for the coffee shops?
No, I wasn't, but there were actual lines for the coffee shops here for people to get their last bit of weed and hash and all that kind of stuff. The hospitality businesses were closed down basically within 40 minutes yesterday, which was quite unheard of. And today there are actually calls from mayors of cities and from owners of coffee shops to at least get a some kind of takeaway policy for their clients, because otherwise they're afraid of some more illegal drug trafficking going on in the streets,
well, yeah,
which are completely empty. So, I mean, on the other hand, they're easy to spot because the drug traffickers are out there and no one else is.
That's true. In the meantime, the football's been suspended in an incredibly suspenseful moment with the top two, Ajax and AZ Level. Very much down the other end, we kind of wanted to ask you about Alan Pardew at Den Haag. Given the hiatus, a chance to reflect on his first, 100 days in charge. How much of a success has it been, Mikhail?
Well, it started out really well, and everyone, both in the UK and in the Netherlands, were just really surprised that he took on a job such as the Ado Den Haag one. He started out with a win against bottom team RKC Waalwijk, so everything looked really well. But from that point on, things kind of escalated in a negative fashion, because they've hardly picked up any points since. And Ado Den Haag isn't the most stable club anyway. So, in the end, people were first kind of happy to see him there. Now a bit more mixed in their reactions towards him.
Sure, they're winless now in 7 games, 7 points from safety. The most recent result, a 4-0 defeat by AZ. But as you say, they weren't doing particularly well before he arrived anyway, which is why they made the change mid-season. So how much of this is his responsibility, would you say?
Well, the brand of football that he has adapted since he came in has been kind of negative. So in that sense, that's been the main reason that he got quite a lot of flack. And as you say, before he came in, they didn't do well either. But I don't think the people at Ado Den Haag at that point were particularly worried. Alfons Groenendijk, former Manchester City player, was their head coach, and he was quite popular. But the club itself has been in a bit of a turmoil recently anyway, in the last few years, because they've been taken over by a Chinese group called the United Fansen. There are now new rumors of new takeovers, investments and everything. And it basically has been like that for quite some time. And Alan Pardew, when he came in, he dropped some of the players that had been brought in that summer. He has brought in quite a British contingent as well, but only one of them is actually starting games as it is, and he's quite fickle in terms of tactics that he has adopted as well. So, yeah, I mean, he's not the most popular man in town, but right. I mean, given his history in the UK, I think he's quite used to that anyway. So,
Mikhail, there was a lot of notice paid to the welcome that you mentioned that the fans gave Alan and Chris Powell with the Ghostbusters, who you're going to call, Pardew and Powell banners. Although I understand De Telegraph was less enthusiastic, describing him as a narcissist from Wimbledon when he arrived.
Yeah.
But more recently then, disgruntled fans kind of invaded the training camp with a kind of flipboard and gave a bit of a tactical lesson. Was that their attempt to get Pardew back on track? And how well did it have any impact on him and the team's performances?
Well, he himself was quite surprised by that, as he should. And Ado Den Haag in general, their fans are known for being a bit, well, I would say goofy. Like they like to throw in an odd joke here and there. And this is kind of up their street. Alan Pardew wasn't amused at all. So I don't think it has helped at all. And he himself said, well, we've just had quite a decent performance, or at least they gained a point against Heerenveen, which is respectable for them. Why are the fans barging in on a training session like this at this point? And I think he has underestimated how difficult the club it is. I think he has underestimated also what his profile is in this country. And I mean, he doesn't seem willing to give up, which I think is quite brave, but yeah, it's going to be a really, really difficult challenge to get everything back on track, because it's not like the fixture list is very kind to him. One small point I must say in his defense, it is kind of unlucky. This is the first season where we see two teams from the Eredivisie relegate directly rather than in the playoffs. So, I mean, if he was in that position last season, it would have been fine. But yeah, for this season, it really looks like a difficult jam to get out of.
Right. They can pick up any points they can, wherever they can. Like the residents of Amsterdam, desperate to get their hands on any draw at the moment. Mikael, thank you so much for joining us. And as soon as things get back up and running any day now, it'd be great to get some more updates.
Okay, cheers. Cool. Take care, guys.
Apropos of the narcissist from Wimbledon, Berto says, I'd like to know if there's been a worse managerial spill ever than Pardew's at West Brom, which featured, you'll no doubt recall, Taxigate in Barcelona.
Oh, yeah.
where four West Brom squad members basically got arrested for stealing a taxi. Players furious, this from Berto, at the lack of any tactical preparation for games and only one league win in the entire 18-game spell. Can you think of one, Jules?
We had this season Antoine Comboiré at Toulouse,
okay,
who took the job, and Stein saying in his press conference, his first press conference, saying, I haven't watched football in the last 6 months.
I like it.
And how did it work out for him at Toulouse?
One win, 10 defeats, including one against a fourth division team.
I think Berto's point, though, that it's not just the terrible results. It's the fact this kind of complete dereliction of kind of leadership with players.
Yeah, no, we never had Taxigate and things like that. This right. is probably, in recent years, I think this has to be one of the worst that we've had.
Germany, Rafa?
Well, I mean, this season, Jurgen Klinsmann had a pretty devastating impact.
Yeah,
I mean, he
true.
Did actually win a few points. And those points might make the difference for Hertha as far as not going down is concerned.
Persuaded the club to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, but there was some collateral damage, shall we say, not least to his own reputation.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
Hmm. Anyone in Italy, James?
Surely you've got millions.
No, I don't know. I think managers tend to be pretty serious in...
I mean, there are lots of managers who've come in mid-season and lost five games in a row.
Silvio Baldini kicking other managers up the bum.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah, Baldini, the Bielsa of Italian football. Yeah, who's now coaching Cadarese for free.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, people like Malisani who, you know.
Hey, there's a Golazzo all about him.
Yeah.
Jules, later on, looking forward to you telling us some more treasured memories, this time involving the first ever Champions League final.
Indeed.
And a bit of scandal in there.
Oh, a bit of Bernard Tapie in there, yeah.
Woof. But next up, a couple of really special questions.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Finding pastel de natas in a London cafe? Special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games? Not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators. Available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Joe. Hello, Joe. Ask, who's the best flawed footballer from your various leagues? I'm referring, says Joe, to players like Berbatov, Cassano, Ozil and Riquelme. All the talent, but none of the discipline. I think you're lumping in a lot of different elements there, Joe, but I hear what you're saying. I mean, if we were restricted to the kind of the Cassanos of this world, you know, those players whose instincts lead them to never quite live up to their
ordering donuts up to the hotel room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Mario Basler, I would say, would feature quite highly.
Right.
Adriano.
Here was a guy who was supremely talented, but didn't quite live the professional lifestyle that I think got the most out of his talents.
What kind of thing did he get up to then, Rafa?
I think it was just, there was a time in the mid to late 90s where football was very modern, but I think the behaviour of the players hadn't quite caught up with that yet, at least in some clubs. And he would go out, he would get involved in some arguments in a pizza restaurant. And, you know, I mean, we're not talking about big sort of scandals, but just like general kind of a sense of, you know, smoking, drinking, doing all the stuff that I think back in the day was probably considered normal, but I think was beginning to be phased out at that time as football's got much more athletic and demanding on the players. And unfortunately, he didn't keep up. And I think he would have been a real superstar in 2020 if he had behaved that way off the pitch.
Right. Jules, I'm pretty sure I remember a French journalist telling me all the secrets of Manuel Adebayor's extraordinary lifestyle in Hampstead.
Yeah, I mean, the best story about Adebayor is that, one of the best, I think, is that he was sleeping in his own Arsenal shirt. which I think is pretty special. That you, not, one, it's not very, I think, comfortable to sleep in a football shirt.
Right.
Even less when it's your own, and you just, I guess, love yourself so much that you go to bed with it. But I would go with Atem Ben Arfa, talking about the French, those flaws, because I think he was an absolute genius of a player. But a bit like Basler and a bit like others that we mentioned, Cassano and the others, was just not up to scratch in terms of how he would live his life. The, on the pitch, he would just do whatever was coming through his head. And often that was trying to nutmeg someone and dribble past five players and then scoring the goal of the season already. Mm-hmm. And he did that many times. That's why it's incredible. But for the rest, between fights with Olas when he was at Lyon, between... you know, argument on the national team. He just should have had a career much better than the one he had.
Could also mention Stefan Effenberg.
Yeah.
Famous for the middle finger, which got him banned from the German national team at a time where he could have been really the best player in Germany. Again, mid-90s. Also, going back a little bit further, Bernd Schuster.
Right.
Bernd Schuster was a genius. Played most of his... professional career in Spain at a time when playing abroad was considered a real detrimental factor to being a German national player. There was almost kind of an unofficial ban on players being abroad as far as eligibility was concerned. He famously, or his wife, who was the agent, famously asked for a lot of money to come back into the team. And Germany said no, which is why we never saw him at the 82 or even 86 World Cup. And it's a real shame because he would have been sensational, I think.
He part of the Fiorentina team that got relegated, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Late on, yeah, late in the
93.
Sort of, yeah. This 92-93.
The twilight of his career, yeah.
But even Ravel before, Morrison, can we have him?
Yeah, just before James mentioned it, even Eric Cantona, the French side of his career was a disaster. For the talent that he had... a very young age, the fact that no one wanted him before he left to England, and he had wasted all those years and all that talent by being completely crazy, is one of those as well, I think.
Right. James, do you want to pitch him one here?
Well, he did a golazo on Adriano.
Oh, yeah.
I think Adriano's a special case.
Cassano being there as well. I mean, he'd be Cassano, probably the ultimate.
Super Mario at the moment, still going. Balotelli. Wow. There's all kinds from back in the day.
Ooh, Alvaro writes in and says Diego Tristan and Zaragoza are his choices.
Okay.
Oh, Zaragoza's for our next question. Right. Yes. I understand why. I thought he'd written the entire team off as completely underperforming. Right. This is from Sam Bryan, who says, which fallen giant from your respective nations would you buy and restore to former glory years? What a lovely question, Sam Bryan. So which one are you having, Rafa?
Well, you recall earlier this season, James, we were kindly sponsored by a football manager.
Yes.
And of course, there was an option to take over Hamburg.
Oh, nice.
And I think that was wisely chosen because they are indeed, I think, the number one sexiest, but at the same time, sort of nuttiest project you'd like to take over. It's kind of...
How much would it cost?
To buy them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have a lot of debt, so you'd have to pick up the debt as well.
Right. You could leverage that, surely. Yeah, isn't that maybe what you do?
I mean, they are sort of the... the femme fatale, that you think you might be the one to tame them.
I'm not saying me, but you know.
Fatale, I love that.
But a lot of people have tried and failed in recent years. And it might not go up again this year, which would be a real blow.
No one might do anything this year. But yeah, okay. Jules?
I'll probably go for Stade de Reims. Although they're in the top flight now and they're having a good season,
right.
It's not as big as they were in the 50s when they were reaching European Cup finals against Real Madrid, when they had players like Raymond Kopa, who won the Ballon d'Or then. And they were really the biggest team in France and one of the biggest in Europe. They've fallen, they almost went completely bankrupt, or in a way they did, and they came back from nowhere. And now it's good to see them established again in the top flight. But yeah, I would go over there and make them a giant club again.
Nice. What about you, James?
Well, the obvious one is Milan. But the thing is, even though they've got good owners who are pumping lots of money in, with FFP, you're limited in what you can do. But from a romantic side, I would actually choose the David that became a Goliath in the 90s, which is Parma.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
That would be lovely,
Parma.
Because I think people still have a great fondness, affection for that club.
Right.
And to see it kind of ran well, but with this kind of same money kind of being pumped into it. We're talking about outside of the FFP paradigm,
right,
it would just be magnificent, I think.
Wow. Yeah. To a Tansy on them.
I get Tino Asprilla as my kind of club ambassador.
That'd be incredible. He would be amazing. I imagine him like Flavor Flav with a giant clock around his neck.
Yeah. We would have his condom brand would be one of the sponsors on the you know, when you do the flash interview on the backdrop.
You,
the backdrop. That would be good.
And maybe this time they could win titles without cheating.
And
well.
We that would
what the hell?
Come on, the Marseille final, the UEFA Cup final.
What was wrong with that?
Well, I think there's a few transfusions at some point before the game, clearly.
I'd also get Tino to, before the game,
right,
to ride around the stadium on a horse in a Barney, in a Barney outfit.
Barney outfit. I'm still agog at the notion of Jules complaining about Italian sides with transfusions in European finals.
That's the fact.
We're going to get
You know Horncastle. Yeah. He knows as well.
Okay.
Next week.
I think you win from Jules. Tino Spriglia is sporting director.
Thank you.
Ka-ching. All right. Dean Brown says, best football films or docs to watch over the next few weeks. Well, Nick Miller has just put together a page for our Totally Football Show website with YouTube highlights of every single European Cup and Champions League final ever. I think that's going to be out on Tuesday. So that's pretty special. I know that Daniel Story has done a fantastic piece as well with loads of different links to documentaries and stuff. But excitingly, Rafa, we are going to be inaugurating on Thursday our very own Flicks and Kicks Football Film Club, where we'll be kind of questing for the perfect football film.
Wow.
And I hope you, listener, will be joining us on that quest. Boxing has Rocky. Baseball has Field of Dreams. Jamaican bobsleigh has Cool Runnings. Why can't football have
goal.
An iconic...
Yeah, goal one, two and three.
Yeah, well,
I once saw one of them on the plane.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Exactly.
Beckham's cameo is quite something.
Yeah. We'll start our search with Green Street, Elijah Wood and Jon Favreau do hooligans.
My name is Matt Buckner. Last spring, I got kicked out of Harvard 2 months shy of my diploma. But what I was about to learn, no Ivy League school in the world could teach me.
Yep, a Cockney accent. It's brilliant. The whole thing is on YouTube. Search Green Street Hooligans, which was the American title for this picture. And then send us your thoughts, listeners, on Green Street, brackets, hooligans, for Thursday's show. Fantastic. Rafa, did you have a top football film or documentary you wanted to suggest for Dean Brown?
The This Is Football series on Amazon is very good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? What's that?
It's a number of unconnected features. One is, for example, on football in Rwanda and the role it played to bring the two fighting tribes back together.
Mm-hmm.
One is on the importance of chance in game.
Chance?
Chance.
As in chances in things you sing or fortune?
Fortune.
Fortune, yeah, chance.
Right, okay.
Explained in relation to the 2012 final and the 1999 final. And also the German Cup final in 2018.
The 1999 final, what was their conclusion about chance on that one?
Well, Colina's on it. He's quite good, actually.
Is he?
Yeah, drinking an espresso very stylishly, as you can imagine. And there's a contributor from the Totally Football Europot is on it as well, with Munich connections.
The self-promotion never stops.
I have to say, that does sound
really
interesting.
Good. It is very good.
And where would you find
Oliver
that?
Kahn is
on Amazon?
It. Yeah. And there's one on Messi. There's six in total, and they're all very good.
Okay, that sounds great.
Super lavish production values, drones flying over cities and stuff.
It's wow. Yeah. Pulled out all the stops. James, of course, for you, it's Love is Blind. And
yes, it still is.
Jules, anything you'd recommend?
Watch it with Mrs. Onyxstein. I mean,
all the recent ones, the Maradona documentary in Mexico is brilliant. The one on Leeds, I thought, is really good. The one on Sunderland. But nothing can be the 2012 being Liverpool. With Brendan Rodgers, which I think was the first one really of its kind. Mm-hmm. And if you can, rewatch it. I mean, the envelopes, everything. Brendan Rodgers at his best.
Is that on Netflix?
So it was on Channel 5, wasn't it, in this country? And on Fox, I guess, in the US? But I'm sure,
I'm sure you'd find it.
Yeah.
I think Liverpool have burnt all the tapes.
Yeah, Brendan Rodgers all the tapes, so no one could watch them again.
But yeah, I mean, Maradona is probably the ultimate football
has to film. Be watched.
Asif Kapadia at his best.
All right, then. Lots of good things out there, and we'll have more suggestions as the pods go by. And next up, though, it's time for a little bit more zombie football.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Tall Swedish strikers with little ponytails, special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games, not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators. Available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Zombie football.
That's right, everybody. Zombie football, digging up classic moments from long dead seasons, reanimating some golden moments that have got buried under all the new stuff. That music can mean only one thing. Well, it actually can be two, because it's James Horncastle's ringtone.
Yeah, favourite song. He had it at his wedding. Do you remember that?
But in this case, it means we're going back to 1993. Jules, when you were... How old were you in
1993?
Right. You were unlimited.
I was unlimited indeed.
As you romped around the streets of Paris.
Indeed.
Now, also going on in 1993 was the first and still only European Cup won by a French team.
Indeed. Olympique de Marseille against AC Milan in Munich in that final in May 1993.
Yeah, certainly. Were you there, Raf?
The problem is I can't remember. All I remember is that a friend of mine had two tickets,
right,
and tried to sell them. And it was a whole odyssey. This is before the internet, before, you know, he went to lots of hotels in Munich and tried to do deals with a concierge. It was a whole thing. And in the end, I don't know if I went or not. I just remember the final being very, very boring.
Wow. Well, you're going to love this next bit.
Hang tight.
I mean, boring, but not for France, eh? How excited was the country about this?
I mean, Jules was thrilled. Yeah. I mean, as a born and bred Marseille fan.
Not in my area code. I mean, we had a few Italians in our neighborhoods, and they had all the flags and the Milan flags outside their windows and everything. So we were rooting for them. Especially us as PSG fans. No, but the country was big. Marseille was so big at the time. Right. Tapie was so big as well. Let's not forget. He was such a huge figure, not just in French football, but in French politics at the time. On television, he was everywhere all the time.
He was the Berlusconi who got busted.
Exactly. No, but it's true. And I don't think he would argue with that. And him being compared to Berlusconi, I think would suit him anywhere, whether he got busted or not. But so it was a really big time. And it looked like finally France would be recognized as one of, you know, top countries of football, because why are you laughing?
No, in terms of club football, I think you mean.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, as long as one of your clubs hasn't won it, it's, right, you don't really belong.
Yep. Farmers
terms of
League.
Football, of course, multiple world titles and European titles, you've got nothing to prove there.
No.
But the curious thing about this moment. The curious thing about this match in 1993 was that it pitted the Berlusconi who got busted and the Berlusconi who hasn't quite been, against each other in one European final. Now, there was previous. In 1990-91, Milan, who'd won back-to-back European titles, met Marseille in the quarterfinals, wasn't it?
That's right.
And that Milan team was something. We've talked about them again in Golazzo, one of the all-time greats, managed by Arrigo Sacchi. But Marseille as well had a pretty special lineup.
Yes, it was fantastic. I mean, Jean-Pierre Papin was obviously leading the line up front, and Chris Waddle, who just arrived from Spurs.
Magic Chris,
who scored that wonderful volley, not remembering it because he just got a knock on the head, and he was actually dizzy when the ball arrives, and he doesn't even remember how he scored that goal. He just can remember.
He scores it with one of the things that Jules loves, his weaker foot. And all of their front three are involved in that move in some way or another. Abedi Pele, Papa,
right,
and then Magic Chris.
Magic Chris.
Waddle Abdi Pele, who of course is still very much a presence in our football with his sons Jordan and Andre Ayew.
Yeah, indeed.
The story goes that he turned up playing for 1860 Munich, as you know.
Is this Abdi Pelé?
Yeah, in his later stages of his career. And apparently they had told him, you're signing for Munich. And he thought he's going to Bayern. But he signed for 1860.
I think this was the case with Stefan Mbia as well, was it?
Yeah,
when he was like, you're going to Rangers. And he's like, oh, Rangers, big club. Basil Boli used to play there. Yeah. And then he turned and he's at QPR.
Right, like, right. Abdi Pelé also turned up at Torino later on. A lovely chat. I actually had a chance to meet him.
Really?
But I wonder if he possibly was, you know, thought he was definitely with the other cheering club. But anyway. No,
he thought he got an interview with Channel 4 in France or something.
Right. Anyway, maybe
the 91 team that then lost in the final on penalties to Red Star was better than the 93 team that beat Milan in the final this time.
Because that didn't have Chris Waddle.
No, then Alain Boksic, for example. Yeah. Papin and Waddle had left, Boksic and...
Yeah, cardboard Boksic.
And Rudy Fowler was there as well in that team and others. But maybe 91 is better than 93, actually.
All right. And also, I mean, Chris Waddle, it's not just the goals. The cultural impact that he had on French society was pretty huge, no, Jules?
Huge, especially with that one song that everybody still remembers.
What song's that, Jules?
The one with Basil Boli.
Basil, to tell the truth, in my cradle, in my early youth, I kicked, I punched my rubber balls with great emotions, I recall.
To be fair, that's really bad, Jules.
It is really bad. They did sell a few, though.
Did they
sell a few. Yeah. In terms of worst or best songs by football players, it has to be
like that. His own collaboration with Glenn Hoddle, of course, Diamond Light.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is actually a really great song in its genre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't have it myself, but I'm always happy to listen to it. You know, it was of its time. And Papin, as you say, who'd got them the goal with which they drew at San Siro.
Yeah, wonderful pass from Waddle in that goal as well. Check it out. It's on my Twitter feed.
Oh, lovely. Okay, so this is in the 1991 season. And then, having drawn 1-1 with Marseille at San Siro, Milan go to France for the second leg.
The Velodrome, yeah.
And this is where things really get interesting because Marseille take the lead with that goal from Chris Waddle, 75th minute. And with 2 minutes left, what happens, Jules?
Great sportsmanship from Milan. One of the four floodlights at the Velodrome breaks down. You can still see very clearly. I can still remember watching that game on television. You can still see the pitch very clearly. And the Milanese go like, we can't continue. This game has to be abandoned.
So the referee actually suspends the game because you have to. The floodlights start to go. And when 15 minutes later they said, OK, we can go on with the game, Milan refuse.
Yeah. Adriano Galliani, you hear him on sort of sideline mics picking up, going, via, via, let's get gone. Let's go. Get off the pitch.
So they claim that the television crews had disrupted the match by going out onto the field and presumably were hoping for the game to be awarded to them as opposed to...
That's pretty much they were trying everything to get that game.
Come on, Jules, you were rooting for them at that stage. You were like, come on, yes.
Yeah. I was like, this would be wonderful if Marseille lost that one in that manner. But they didn't. And in fairness, Marseille over the two legs were by far the better side. So
UEFA declared it a forfeit and awarded the victory to Marseille. They went on to the final, got beaten by Red Star on penalties in what is possibly the dullest European final ever played.
But do you want a story on the semi-final against Spartak Moscow?
Okay.
The first game away in Russia. Bernard Tapie, just before the game, goes up in the press box.
So Bernard Tapie is the president.
He's the president of Marseille since...
And a politician and playboy and actor.
So he takes over in 1986.
Right.
At that time, the last French title that Marseille won was in 76.
Uh-huh.
And that season, they finished 15th. And in the space of, between 86 and 91, let's say, he's transformed that team completely by investing a lot of his, you know, his own money. At the time, obviously, there's no FFP, nothing.
Giving them an injection.
But let's just start with the legal stuff.
Okay.
Just buying players. Like Chris Waddle. You're going to love that story. Like Chris Waddle and, you know, Deschamps Desailly, all of that. Building great teams, not just the 91, but then rebuilding a new team for 93. But in 91, the story goes that he goes up in the press box in Moscow before the game starts he sits next to this the local Marseille newspaper guy who he knows very well, and he takes a piece of paper and he writes something on the piece of paper, folds the piece of paper, gives it to the Marseille correspondent guy, and he said, just read it at the end of the game, right? Marseille won 3-1 away in Moscow. And at the end of the game, the journalist opened a piece of paper and he said 3-1.
I thought it was going to be the name
of... That is amazing.
I thought it was going to be the name of three players that let them down.
No, wait, you know why? Because then Tapi would reveal later that the players whose socks were the lowest, so the ones who didn't have their socks all the way up to the knees were the ones that were... Allegedly, because still nothing has been proven.
But
allegedly.
So what? No, okay. But why would he go and reveal that to a journalist?
Because that was Bernard Tapie for you. He was bragging all his life. He'd been bragging. He started as a salesman, television. He could sell anything to anyone, and that's how he became so big. I mean, the Adidas deal was mental.
So that's right. In 1990, he acquires Adidas, Rafa, and owns them for what, 3 years, I think.
Yeah, something like that. Turn them around, to be fair. And then sell them. And then it's still very complicated. And to this day, the whole sale of Adidas hasn't been to Robert Louis Dreyfus at the time. Has still not been really cleared. But he basically needs to pay back 400 million euros.
Right, which he was awarded from the French government. Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Well, we'll get onto that perhaps later on. But way back in the early 90s, UEFA have banned Milan from European competition for a year because of their refusal to play on at the Velodrome. But 2 years later, with the European Cup now the Champions League, Milan make it to the first ever final. And who should they meet but Marseille? Extraordinary route that you had to take to get to the final in those days, because you had a first knockout round and then a second knockout round. And then you went into a group stage with two sets of four teams. And the winners of those two groups met in the final. There was no semi-finals or anything. Extraordinary.
Weird, yeah.
It was, and it was open to new countries as well, like Ukraine and Estonia. So you had the first one, for example, Marseille beat Glen Torren from Ireland, 8-0 on aggregate. I think Milan beat Ljubljana or something like
Ljubljana.
Like 6-7 as well. That was basically the first one was given to you. Then you had what could be like a toughest last 16 round, if you want, where Barcelona, who won the European Cup in 92, were knocked out, for example, by CSKA Moscow. And yeah, it was a weird format, but a format that suited Marseille, because I guess in the group stage, they didn't need to do as much as, corruption if they wanted to, for example, to qualify.
So they won three of their group games.
Yeah, and drew the three against Rangers, Bruges and CSKA Moscow.
Right, whereas Milan won all six of their games and looked absolutely...
Yeah,
on
I mean,
fire.
This is, if we go back to 91 just briefly, it was a feeling that Sacchi had ran that team into the ground, that they couldn't keep playing the intense football that he wanted them to play, and they'd come to an end of a cycle. Capello comes in and the team feels better. You know, if you look at how they started that season under Capello, 92-93, they have that 5-4 against Pescara, they have the 7-3 against Fiorentina, they have the 5-3 against Lazio. It gets to March and they are 58 games unbeaten in the league, which remains a record. So they were seen as the best team in the world, one of the best teams of all time. And in the meantime, Marseille's top scorer, best player, Jean-Pierre Papin, had moved to Milan.
Yeah, they'd picked him up. He was only on the bench for the final, though.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
But that remarkable Rossoneri lineup, going with Van Basten and Massaro. Hullet, I think, was injured at the time.
Hullet was left in the stands.
Right.
Because him and Capello no longer seemed eye to eye. And one of the reasons why this game is significant in the history of Milan is that it's the last one that the three Dutchmen... It's the end of the era of the three Dutchmen, because Hullet goes on loan to Sampdoria.
Right.
It's Van Basten's last game for the club, because a few weeks later he'll have ankle surgery, which will prove to be catastrophic. And Frank Rijkaard moves to Ajax. So this is the end.
Boli dans l'axe. Marcel de Sailly au second poteau. Et but! But de Boli! But de Basile Boli sur ce corner.
Eh bien, c'est le moment idéal.
The corner that leads to the goal shouldn't have been given. And the referee, what happened to him a few years later?
Called Rüdisberger. He was banned for life.
Yeah, he was banned for life.
He was banned because he approached FC Basel, I think, and said, "Would What do you think about 100,000 francs?
I think it was
for the Russian referee. Was it Grasshoppers?
Yeah,
I think okay. It was. Well, he approached another Swiss club and he said, what do you think about 100,000 Swiss francs for this Russian referee who's refereeing your game? That would be the price for you at least not getting, I think he phrased it as disadvantageous decisions against you. And he was reported and then was banned for life after a lengthy investigation. He later also tried to buy lots of tickets for U 2008 using fake names and addresses and was again done for that.
Extraordinary. And he was the man in charge.
He's the man. Yeah. He's the man in black in this game.
Yeah, all right.
Just before half time, the corner, 44th minute. Mm. And the romantic story is that Basil Boli, who scored the header, had been injured, had bad knees all for weeks before the final, was not sure about playing the final, played the final, but after 40 minutes, asked to come off. He said, like, I can't continue, I can't run anymore. And Raymond Goethals, the Belgian manager, who was the Marseille manager at the time, comes to see him on the touchline and said, Tapie says, you can't come off. I'm sorry, Tapie doesn't want you to come off. You can't come off. And 4 minutes later, he jumps somehow and heads the ball in.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
Well, they had great doctors, of course, at Marseille. So. it was a phenomenal team. We should talk about one or two other of the other players they had, because you had Didier Deschamps anchoring things in
the
midfield.
Water boy.
Yeah, the water boy.
You Marseille also had Versailles. Fabien Barthez. That was his first season, I think.
Yeah, that's a young
he still
Fabien
had hair.
Barthez. Yeah, yeah, he came from Toulouse and was outstanding.
Wow. He had a similar kind of cut to you in 92, 93, James. No?
That's very
kind
true.
Of, that kind of
curtain fading hair.
Kind of thing. What?
I don't have a curtain.
Have you not seen? No, it's just kind of like a little tufty kind of thing going on.
Tufty,
definitely, yeah. Definitely.
Right.
And you have Franck Sauzet, who you know, who then went to play in Bergamo, no, Atalanta.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He played for Atalanta, and then obviously to in Scotland. But who had an incredible Champions League that season? Him and Bocek carried that team through those group stages. Game against Rangers, he scored. He also scored 3 goals against CSKA Moscow, hat trick from a from midfield. He was a fantastic player that season for them, and they had a really, really strong team.
Right. Well, at this point, any Rangers fans listening are thinking, yeah, congratulations, Marseille, but I've got one or two questions about what happened next, because it wasn't long before scandal overtook this performance, this team, and particularly Bernard Tapie.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few suspicions before, and Arsene Wenger, for example, when he was at Monaco, before going to Japan and before coming to Arsenal, always had that suspicion that his own players at Monaco had been, like, bought.
Got to
by Tapie and Marseille, to the point that we think two of the titles that Marseille won between 89 and 92, so they won 4 in a row, were maybe really dodgy, to the point that they stole them from Monaco,
so,
if you want.
So they were stripped of the 92-93
yes,
title.
For
because it was proven that they'd paid Valenciennes players to throw a match.
You were coached by?
Boro Primorac.
Arsene Wenger's future assistant.
Yeah. Right.
So Arsene Wenger saved Boro Primorac's life, basically, because after this, no one would ever employ him again. He was the Valenciennes coach at the time, doing a good job, or at least not doing a bad job.
And they were facing Marseille about 6 days before the European Cup final. Tapie tells one of his players, who used to be teammates with some of their team, get in touch and see what it'll take to make sure they don't give us a hard time before our big match.
So 3 players, Jacques Glassman, the centre-back and the captain, Jorge Buruchaga, the World Cup winner with Argentina, and Christophe Robert. So 2 forwards and 1 defender were bought to sort of play lightly the game to make sure that no Marseille players would get injured before the Champions League final. We found 250,000 francs at the time, so 40,000 euros kind of thing, or pounds, buried in the garden, under the grass of the garden of Christophe Robert's parents, or in-laws. And then they all basically confessed that the money came from Jean-Jacques Edley, the Marseille midfielder, on orders from Bernard Tapie via Jean-Pierre Bernès, who is now
an agent,
but was for many years Tapie's number 2, if you want. Him and another guy called Marc Frattani, who had worked with Tapie for 30 years and who's the one who confessed it all and said that all those games were corrupt. He didn't say it was mass corruption. He said it was a targeted corruption. So the idea was not to buy every single game and every single opposition team.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right.
But just a few. That's why we think that some of the Monaco players maybe had been bought. And if you watch a game, some of those games between Marseille and Monaco, a few of them never jump on corners.
Keep your eye on their socks as well.
And on their socks, yeah. Maybe. and then suddenly this Valenciennes game, there's another one that Fratani said, one of the PSG Marseille, where himself went to see the referee of the game the following day to give him the cash.
Wow.
So there's a few of those. So, but certainly the Valenciennes one.
So this is in Ligue 1. They're stripped of the title. Benatapi is untouchable because he's got parliamentary immunity for this, but he'll come across a
herd immunity
later. Herd immunity. But in the Champions League, whilst they retain their European title, there are many questions about some of the other matches there. The CSKA Moscow game, they lost 6-0. Yeah, the Velodrome. And there's a lot of suggestions of something in the water that night.
Yes.
And I think Rangers, as I mentioned, have a lot of doubts and misgivings about their games.
Yeah, so Fratani says that what they used to do is they used to always leave bottles of water already ready in the away dressing room at the Velodrome for the opposition team. But that in those bottles of water that looked brand new and unopened, via a little syringe, they would just inject loads of drugs and stuff for the players to be, you know, not at their best, basically. And that had been on for years and years. And Fratani, I mean, Tapi says, you know, Fratani can name names and this is not the truth. But Fratani says, I did it myself on order from Bernard Tapi. So, I mean, you believe who you want to believe. It's either Tapi or his right-hand man. But one of them is lying for sure. One of the two is lying.
And then additionally, in Jean-Jacques Edeli's autobiography, he basically writes that they all doped for the final against Milan. Yeah. The only time I agreed to take a doping product, writes Jean-Jacques, was the 93 Champions League final. We all took a series of injections. And I felt different during the game as my physique responded differently under strain. The only player who refused to take part was Aunt Rudy.
Yeah.
Aunt Rudy Voller.
Rudy Voller didn't want to. And if you, even now, if you ask some players, even like Deschamps, they don't really answer straight away.
Luckily, he got clear of all that stuff and went to Juventus shortly after.
Yeah, where methods were very, very different.
Very different.
It was the idea, and for Tapi, it was the same, that to win, you could do anything. And that was very much his mojo in business, in politics, in sports. It was that was the idea, that there was nothing that you could not do to win.
Right. And there's nothing that Bernard Tapie could not do. You mentioned it before, president, playboy, politician, actor. Even pop star.
Le ministère, c'est toujours le gangster. Tu contrôles l'affaire. C'est beau la vie.
Yep, that's him. A great video, by the way, collaborating with the Doc Gineco.
Yeah, Doc Gineco, the French rapper.
Yeah.
I mean, the funny thing is Tapi, to repeat one of my favorite expressions, as you know, is Paris born and bred kid. And he made Marseille so good and so big, and credit to him.
Yeah.
And now he's 77.
Yeah.
He's 77. He's beaten skin cancer.
Right.
Throat cancer, stomach cancer, and now has just revealed that he's got lung cancer.
Oh, wow.
But the guy isn't just invincible, unbeatable.
So he was awarded 400 million from what, euros?
Euros now.
From the French government over the sale of Adidas, which was basically when he got into trouble, legal trouble, that was then sold off by lawyers to...
By a bank, by his bank, Crédit Lyonnais. He said, I give you Adidas and you sell it on my behalf, basically.
Right. Then he argued, why did the French government owe him 400
because
million?
Because it was a bank that the French government had interest in, or like shares in.
Okay.
And Tapi always said that they basically did him over the amount they sold it for.
Right.
But it turned out in recent years, so that took a very long time, a long investigation with twist all the time, that Tapi knew exactly... pretty much what they were doing. And that's why the whole sentence was reversed and that he has to pay back that money now, because it seems that he was part of the whole dodgy deal in
I
the first place,
that.
Which is just, I mean...
So, but back then, in like 93, he was famous as a local politician in Marseille, but then became a national... He was a minister, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was ministre de la ville, yeah.
Right.
In two governments.
Like urban affairs?
Yeah, urban affairs, yeah, okay. Urban minister.
And then by the mid-90s, he goes bankrupt because he's been thrown out of parliament because of all of this. He takes to the stage. He plays the lead in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
But before that, he goes to jail as well. Let's not forget that for the Valenciennes, you know, corruption game.
Oh, he does go to jail
So he goes, first he gets a year in jail and a year suspended. Then he appeals, and that's reduced to 8 months. He will do 6 months. But for 6 months, he went to jail.
I thought he went to jail for corruption and witness tampering. Was that for the same case?
Yeah, yeah, same for the same case. Right. Yeah. And there's loads of other cases in terms of transfers and other games and all of that that he got away with.
Right. I always think that, I mean, it's maybe different now with American ownership, but when you see those Amazon series about, you know, going behind the scenes at a football club, if I was a producer, I'd be like, I'd love to do a kind of behind the scenes thing there.
But even Tapie himself, it deserves a movie about him. He deserves more books because he's really one of those characters that we will never see again in football. Like you had in Italy and you know, those kind of characters that I don't think we will ever see again.
Mm. Also that year, famous 92-93 for Stuttgart against Leeds. That was the first round, which you had to survive to get into the second round. And then the third round was the round robin with the four teams.
Right.
The double semi-final. And Stuttgart had won the first game in Stuttgart 3-0. And they were 4-1 behind at Leeds in the second leg, going through on away goals. When Christoph Daum, the same manager who would later fall foul
cocaine in his hair.
Which couldn't happen to just anyone, but it did to him.
Yeah.
He brought on a fourth foreigner by mistake. Ooh. Back then, you could only play
three foreigners
plus two foreigners who'd been effectively assimilated. Yeah. Yes.
And so did Leeds get it overturned as a result?
Well, Leeds, the interesting thing is that usually the punishment would have been a 3-0 win for the opposition team. But of course, in this case, it would have been enough. So what UEFA did is they ordered a third game on neutral ground in Barcelona.
In Barcelona, yeah.
Which Leeds won.
Brilliant.
I'd forgotten about that.
How different football was in those days. For a start, they actually used to play it.
We should just do, like, we should do European years.
Yeah, well, let's do that.
Next week, we should 93-94.
What happened then?
Exactly, I'll tell you next week.
Okay,
Champions League,
it's one of my all-time favorite performances from
the
team in the final.
The Milan Barcelona
93-94.
Yeah, Milan Barcelona.
We were talking about it only yesterday on this very podcast.
Yeah, with two different clubs for
not bad.
Marcel,
probably the best final performance.
Well,
at least until the Barcelona's.
Yeah,
20 years later.
Let's not give away too much about that very special season. We'll do that next time around.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Listen, I hope you enjoyed today and will join us for that in a week's time. We, of course, are going to be back on Thursday. It's going to be a busy show. We've got the commentary quiz, Jack Lang with all sorts of stuff there. And as I mentioned, Flicks and Kicks, do watch Green Street and give us your thoughts. But for now, many, many thanks to Raphael Honigstein, James Horncastle and Julien Laurent.
Hey, James.
Stay well, everybody. We'll be back soon enough. Have a great time till then, listener. Cheerio.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter. And make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Muddy Knees Media.